Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,500 podcasts, visit www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Jen McGivney, author of Finding Your Weldon, How to Strive Less, Simplify More, and Embrace What Matters Most. Finding Your Weldon is self-help meets Choose Your Adventure, inspired by the philosophy of Thoreau. It applies a journalist's lens to a misunderstood literary icon, exploring how experts, psychologists, leaders, and scholars support Thoreau's principles as guideposts for today's great reassessment, and how they can be adapted today and why they should. As people reassess priorities to create values-based lifestyles in a profit-based society, Thoreau's life offers a precedent and his philosophy provides a path. Finding Your Weldon isn't about shunning money or success. It's about grappling with the purpose of the first and meaning of the second. Thoreau sets us on a path to discover fulfillment and happiness. We just need to stop at the cabin on our way. Jen McGivney is a writer in Charlotte, North Carolina. She's the back page columnist for Charlotte Magazine, and her work also appears in Success Magazine, Our State Magazine, and Southern Living, among others. She has a master's degree in English and a soft spot for transcendentalists. For more information, you can visit Jen's website, which is jenmcgivney.com, and that's JenMcGivney.com. Okay, with that, I'd like to welcome Jen to the show. Good day, Jen.
Thank you, Robert. Nice to be here.
Thank you. I'm really interested to talk to you about this and Thoreau. I've noticed in the 14 years that I've done this show that sometimes there's like a zeitgeist or something that just happened when, topics kind of scrunch together. And I had recently a guest on the show, and one of their reviews from a magazine was, it was very Thoreau-like, and I thought, "Oh my God, yeah, here I am." And we're talking, and yours is a completely different, take and interpretation of Thoreau. But I just thought it was interesting that this is seems to be a relevant topic of the day.
I think so too. I wrote the book because I really wanted to bring Henry David Thoreau into 2025. I think he is the ideal thinker for our time. I think Walden might be the perfect book for this moment. But at the same time, I understand it's not so easy of a read. And, after a hard day, a lot of people don't want to unwind with 19th century literature. So what I did with this book is I take the ideas of Thoreau and I take them out from behind that dense 19th century prose. And I bring him into this moment, bring his words into everyday language, and also connect him to now, to show how people live these ideas today and what does it look like to live a Thoreau-like life in 2025.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to find out about, how it is that you, became so interested in Thoreau. And I also noticed in the beginning of your book, you indicated that with your challenge of getting friends, to read Thoreau, that you pitched the story to Success Magazine, and it was like pitching the story about barbecue to Vegetarian Times. I thought, wow, that's a picture. So tell us about, how you became interested in how, that pitch, that you, indicated was probably a long shot, but why you even went and did it that way?
I have always loved Thoreau, and I've just really connected with his messages of simplifying life wherever you can, so you can simplify where you can, so you can maximize life in other ways and really focus on what matters to you. But he's got this reputation of being this curmudgeon, this Luddite that is anti-technology and a hermit, and it's not that way at all. So when I pitched that story to Success Magazine, I actually did it in terms of how Thoreau can help you in the workplace, how it can help your professional life, which is completely antithetical to how most people think of Thoreau. And I've never gotten more letters back from readers saying, thank you for this. This is what I was looking for. That they were looking for something other than title and salary in their professional journey, and the ideas of Thoreau were helping with that. And then in the years since then, the similarities between Thoreau's time and ours are just uncanny, and they're getting more so every year, every month. So I wanted to widen the scope a little bit with the book, and it's not just about professional lives, but how he can help us in our personal journeys and in our personal lives.
Yeah, I'm particularly interested in that historical connection. You know, you said how it's, you know, uncanny about it. And then as I was reading, part of the description was with, you know, the political, you know, divisiveness, you know. So can you tell us a little bit more about, you know, those similarities between our time and his time?
Sure, I'd love to. So Thoreau lived from 1817 to 1862, and the connections are just striking. Like, for example, there was a 30-year period during his life where technology advanced faster in those 30 years than it had in the previous 400 years combined. Suddenly, people lived completely differently. How they lived, where they worked, how they worked, how often they communicated, everything changed so quickly and people had to keep up. And, I mean, we get that. And then politics was messy and dirty and divisive. The country was splitting in half. I mean, we get that too. And then industrial capitalism was really advancing, and work was becoming much less human, much more machine. And again, as we're on the precipice of the AI revolution, this is something we completely understand. And then all the while, there's this pandemic, and there's this mysterious lung disease that's going around, and no one can really predict what it's going to do to any one person. So the things that he was dealing with are so similar to what we are dealing with right now. So it just seems to me really wise to go back to talk to him. You're like, well, how did you cope with this? Because he lived in a similar time, and he devoted his entire life to how does one live well in a time that's as volatile? How does one live well in a time that's changing so fast? And I think, I mean, that's pretty much what all of us are coping with right now, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And you know, in your book, you also were mentioning, you know, how not necessarily history repeating itself, but rhyming times. And I like that verbiage, because, you know, even though there's similarities, there's still significant differences.
Right. One thing that always makes me laugh, there's a part in Walden where Thoreau is saying that, so during his lifetime, it was the first time that people had morning newspapers and afternoon newspapers. For the first time, you could have news twice in one day. Thoreau thought this was ridiculous. Like, why would anyone need to read the news two times in one day? And now it sounds, you know, quaint. But at the same time, his concern was people are going to be more connected with what's happening on the other side of the world than they will in their neighborhood. They're going to know what's going on the other side of the world more than they will with their next-door neighbor. So it's another one of those echoes, like where history is rhyming. The concern is the same. The principle is the same, even if we're dealing with, you know, email and the New York Times app and where you can get news, you know, updates every 30 seconds. So, yeah, it's that echoing and that rhyming.
Yeah. It's amazing. And, you know, it makes me wonder, with so much of history being ignored, you know, or are not taught, you know, to the younger people, recognizing that things like this are very cyclical, you know, and that, you know, a lot can be learned. It kind of dismayed me in a way that we're not giving history its due course.
Oh my gosh, Robert, you're speaking my language 100%. Part of this book is a plea to return to humanities. For the past, 25, 35 years, we have been sidelining the humanities and history and literature and philosophy and what it's doing to us. And now we keep saying that we live in these unprecedented times, and we don't. They're unfortunate in many ways, but they're not unprecedented. And even those of us who love history, want to go back and say, people dealt with this before. Why don't we try to learn something from them so we can do better this time?
Yeah, very much so. And when I read that, the unprecedented, I mean, we just hear that constantly on
always.
The news, and in one way, if one does not know history, mm-hmm. it does look like it's unprecedented,
right.
And with that, idea is that, it's kind of making it seem like this is, it's a unique situation and
yeah.
one that, there is no way to work oneself through it,
yeah.
when in fact a path has been, made previously.
And I think that's what really angers me about that, because when you hear unprecedented, it's terrifying. People are terrified, very understandably, because it's such a lonely idea that nothing like this has ever happened to anyone ever before. And I think it's comforting to find people in history who did deal with it and connect with them and say, hey, you too, what did you do? What can I learn from you? And so I completely agree. I think literature and history are so important right now because they're so vitally human and can give us some company during a time that's pretty lonely.
Yeah, very, very much. Now, there was a term that you created to explain mm-hmm. how Thoreau mm-hmm. can help us think about cost and profit called mm-hmm. Waldenomics, and the first Walden principle in your book is know the cost of things.
Mm-hmm.
So give us a little kind of intro to Waldenomics.
Waldenomics is a term I created to turn all of the ideas of Thoreau into a way to help me make better decisions, more value-based decisions. And it all rests on one line in Walden where Thoreau said that the cost of a thing is the amount of life that we trade for it. And I find that so instructive because the world will tell us the price of things, but it's up to us to remember their cost, that we're not just spending our money, we are spending our time and our attention and our energy. We are spending our life, and we get to choose how we do that. And money is an important part of it. I mean, money is an important currency, but it's not the only currency. And with Waldenomics, it helps me think of the broader context of how am I choosing to spend my life.
Wow. Yeah, that's a different way of framing, cost and value,
mm-hmm.
And it's, when you think about it, it's really very logical, but quite often, we don't include the time spent or the energy spent, in achieving something or gaining something, like cost of family time, when pursuing something. But in the scheme of things, that is truly a formula for kind of recognizing the cost of something.
Right. And I think so often we only find value in what we can measure. And that gives you another way to measure it. For example, like an evening spent all night on, say, Instagram or social media, it like technically doesn't cost you any money, but it does cost you your attention and your time and your energy. At the same time, having a long conversation with a friend or going on a long walk with your dog in the woods, those are also free, but they pay you back. That's Waldenomics profit. So really thinking about the all over cost of what are you spending and also what are you gaining?
Wow. Yeah. That's very, very true. And, and that's, if people can expand their view mm-hmm. as a result of reading your book, it'll be, well spent, so to speak.
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So now one of the other concepts or ideas of Thoreau is the power of enough.
Mm-hmm.
When is enough, so to speak?
Right.
So can you talk a bit about Thoreau's perspective on that and how it applies to today's world?
Sure. So when Thoreau went to Walden Pond, the first order of business he had was determining what is necessary for me to live? What do I need to live? And he went, I think it was about 25 things he brought with him, like a desk, a bed, some pots and pans, some basics, and he was really trying to pare down to what does he need in order to live? And then he went back to his real life in a couple of years. You know, he lived back in town again to determine, like, what is enough? At what point do your possessions add to your life? And at what point do they start subtracting from your life? And I really think that's so important for us to do now. And I really believe that to have any shot of happiness or a life well lived, we have to engage in this day-to-day resistance against the culture that we're in, this culture of accumulation. And it continually wants us to work more and to spend more and to scroll more. That's, you know, to keep the machine running, to contribute to the GDP. And I think it's so important to resist that, to define enough, to know we can stop striving so much and accumulating and start living a little more.
Yeah, because, you know, that striving for more, I mean, it is beaten into us, you know, daily. Mm-hmm. And, you know, mm-hmm. when you look around. And so it really does take a conscious effort to beat it back, you know, and to not allow it to, you know, suck us in to, you know, kind of wasting our time in pursuit of something that really isn't necessary.
Right. And I think this society will always tell us who we can be if we just work a little bit more, if we can just make a little bit more, who we might be able to be. And I think when we play that game, we neglect who we are now, but the life that we're living all along. It's so easy to not appreciate what you have all along in pursuit of who you might be one day. And I think that's a dangerous trap to get into. There's no way one can ever win a game when there's a moving goalpost.
Very true, very true. And, you know, the idea of constantly striving just inherently, you know, suggests that where one is or what one has is just not enough.
Right.
And that, I think, is, you know, that constant striving is what creates a whole lot of stress, you know, in people, and especially in families.
Mm-hmm. So much. And I think marketers from just about every industry want to apply shame to so many neutral things. It could be the logo of a car, the cut of your jeans, wrinkles on a face, like completely neutral things. But if they can apply enough shame to these things, they can convince us to buy things, to buy solutions to non-problems. But all the way, I mean, that really diminishes how we perceive our current selves. And I think that's so sad. Because right now we are enough. And to always look at who we can be is to overlook who we already are.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I have to give credit to the women who do these non-makeup kind of, you know, approach, you know, I mean, because it's number one, you know, it's like I'm proud, you know, this is who I am in a way, mm-hmm. you know, and it also it's like, you know, I don't have to put on all of, and buy all of this mm-hmm. stuff, you know, to create a false image in a way.
Right. I totally agree. I love it too.
Yeah, well, now, one of the things that Shimizu also thought, because I was heading toward the retreat, you know, mm-hmm. and then, of course, Walden popped up. So is the importance of retreat, you know, and in your book, one of the principles is to create space between you and the world. Mm-hmm. So, you know, can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. And I think to get started, one thing I would love to correct is a lot of people think of Thoreau as this guy who lived out in the wilderness all of his life. And that's not true. He was only in a cabin for 2 years, and they were the only 2 years of his life he ever lived alone. The rest of his life, he was surrounded by close family, close friends. He always lived with others. But the point of his retreat was to gain just enough space from the world for just long enough so he could basically hear himself think mm-hmm. and to regain his sense of interiority and to tap into his intuition. And I think it's so much harder for us to do right now because we're always plugged in to, you know, we have phones that are constantly pinging us for attention. And it's just so important to take little breaks away in order to retain that sense of interiority and tap into our intuition. And we have to be so intentional about it now because otherwise it'll follow us everywhere.
Yeah, very much. I mean, the idea of constant connection, you know, is being necessary, and that even when there are periods of, you know, no cell service, you know, the, you know, people panicky because, oh my God, you know, what am I going to do? You
right.
know, and yeah, but it's a it shows exactly how dependent we are on this connection, and you know, and it's really showing that, you know, we are missing that self connect, the connection to self, and we're not comfortable being off the grid.
Right. And with the book, what I tried to do when I brought it into the current moment is to show different levels of retreat. And on the far end, I talked about sabbatical and people who would go away on sabbatical, even up to a year, to rediscover, like, who am I outside of work? But, you know, sabbatical just isn't reasonable or affordable for most people. Mm-hmm. So another thing we can do is meditation. For 10 to 15 minutes at a time, meditating every day can actually change the structure of our brains so that we resist those knee-jerk responses. fMRIs show that, I think it was just 15 minutes a day of meditation for, I forgot, like 9 or 10 weeks, changes the structure of your brain. So you're more reasoned in how you approach the world. There's, you know, your amygdala calms down, your prefrontal cortex kicks up, and you're able to engage with the world more thoughtfully. And I think what Thoreau would say there, you can be more intentional. You're tapping into your intuition and not letting the world dictate so much of what you're thinking. Because I think otherwise, when we're always plugged in, we're in this constantly reactive state, and we're reacting to other people's reactions. We're not really having original thoughts. But when we step away for a little bit, we can have those original thoughts. We can think, who am I when it's just me? What do I really care about? And, you know, what don't I really care about?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, you indicate that, you know, during Thoreau's time, he may not have had the success or popularity that one would think, you know, as we do now, but that he did have it among transcendentalists.
Yeah.
You know, so tell us in the introduction, you indicated you have a soft spot for transcendentalists, transcendentalism. Mm-hmm. So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. The movement, the Transcendentalist movement, was largely in New England in the early 1800s. And they were really skeptical of any kind of institution, whether it was any kind of like club or organization or religion, because they really thought the individual was the source of goodness. And they believed in the opposite of original sin. They believed that people are innately good. And it's our goal in life is to not let so much stuff accumulate on top of us, not to have a life of so many distractions that we can't touch into that like innate goodness that we are born with, because that's how we reach our intuition. And if we react authentically with the world, that will guide us to the decisions that we should be making. That'll help us live a values-based life.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Transcendentalists at the time, they were centered in Concord, where Thoreau lived. It was Ralph Waldo Emerson and Margaret Fuller, Bronson Alcott, and Louisa May Alcott. They all lived like within like a mile of each other, and they were this like club of, and they perpetuated the movement. Yeah, it's really cool.
Wow. Yeah. You know, that's real. I love that thought, and I think we need to kind of bring more of that into our daily life.
Yes. What do you think would change if we did?
What do I think would change?
Yeah, how do you think that would change society? How do you think that would change individuals? Why do you think that's important?
Well, first of all, I would think that it would eliminate a lot of the kind of competing with each other. That would be gone. A lot of guilt or shame, or, you know, and the idea of, you know, spending one's time learning about oneself and values would, you know, do away with the idea that self-help, I mean, self-care, you know, is something not to be, is something to be, you know, cherished and practiced rather than, you know, shamed, you know, or looked at as selfish. And then, you know, just simple community, you know, living a life of based on values, good for the community would, you know, I think, you know, the idea of, you know, rising waters lift all boats kind of thing.
I love that. Completely agree.
Yeah. Wow. Now, one of the other topics that you cover in your book is the importance of embracing our inner misfit.
Yes.
Your principle three is embrace your inner misfit. So, boy, you know, a lot of people would wonder about that because, you know, a lot of people, you know, hide that misfit.
Mm-hmm. And it's the same. And I think of Thoreau was, he was a total misfit. I mean, a lot of people in his town thought he was just a total weirdo. Like, he would just walk around all day and collect plant samples, and he just went his own way, and he didn't really care about other people's perception of him. He just cared about enjoying his time and cultivating close relationships. And I think, like, if he lived a life that met his neighbor's approval, and he had this, you know, full-time career in an office in Boston and bought a house, no one would know who he is right now. And the reason why so many people love him so much is that he was willing to be a misfit. He was willing to go his own way. And to think that that's so powerful that now, 175 years later, we're still reading him because we're just so in awe of someone who could just be so fearlessly himself. And what potential it would be if we all were that brave, you know, what we all could contribute if we were all that brave. And it's interesting how economics, this is one thing I learned during the book, is how much economics affects individualism when we have times where there's this wider divide between the wealthy and the not so wealthy. It was Thoreau's time and also in our time. There's this pressure to conform to the ways of the wealthy because there's this idea that, you know, this fallacy that we live in a meritocracy and the people at the top must be the smartest and hardest working people. So everyone else tries to pretend that, you know, well, we're at the top too, and we try to emulate those ways. And that's death to individualism because you have so many people trying to emulate a certain way of living. And what Thoreau is saying is if you determine what's important to you and what matters to you and you're not trying to mimic the ways of other people, you're going to live a much more fulfilled life. His mentor, Ralph Waldo Emerson, his famous quote is, imitation is suicide. And I think, like, it's such a striking quote because if you try to attempt what someone else is doing and imitate what someone else is doing, that is death to your inner self. And that quote is just striking to me, and the dangers of not being able to embrace your inner misfit.
Yeah. And that's, you know, quite a different view of the idea of, you know, that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. You know, the idea, you know, that to imitate someone, you know, for the one who's being imitated, you know, it may be flattering, but the fact is it really, you know, puts forth from the individual, you know, trying to imitate, you know, it takes them, like you say, steps away from their uniqueness.
Right. And it's also really expensive to imitate other people. It's like it takes so much time and energy and money to imitate the lives of others, and not feeling the pressure to do that can give you so much of that time and energy and money back. I was talking to people who have capsule wardrobes. Are you familiar with a capsule wardrobe?
No.
Oh, this is neat. This is really neat. So instead of having a closet full of all sorts of clothes and stuff, they have a capsule wardrobe, which is kind of like a few items, maybe like 30, maybe 40 items of this carefully curated wardrobe that reflects their personal style. It doesn't follow trends of the moment. Everything's well made. Everything kind of goes together. So there are fewer decisions to be made. There are fewer things to grab out of your closet. And what they said was, we feel such freedom not following the trends of the moment, tapping into our inner style, knowing what works for us. And like, we no longer have to buy so much stuff. We're just free from shopping and free from wanting things, and like Instagram ads mean nothing to us anymore. And they were just so happy and having their time and energy back. And I think of if we applied that to so many things about, you know, how we lived, where we lived, what kind of house we choose, not keeping up with what other people are doing can really give us a lot of time, energy, and money back.
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't know it, but I do have a capsule water.
There you go.
Yeah, there is just like one portion, you know, of my closet that is what I wear
mm-hmm.
all the time.
Yeah.
All the time. And then when one of them, you know, like a jeans rip, you know, I mean, excessively, you know,
mm-hmm.
then they're replaced, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I'm definitely not into one of you know, buying brand names. I'm more, you know, give me value,
right.
And you'll get my attention. So
exactly.
Yeah.
And most people wear 20% of their clothes 80% of the time. And then you think of, like, ecological ramifications of that, like how much waste there is because we're buying so much more than we need. And this all goes back to finding what's enough, like buying enough and then stopping, and what that could do for our landfills and our oceans. The ramifications go so far beyond ourselves.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, so I am now educated in the capsule wardrobe.
You have a capsule wardrobe and you didn't even know it.
There you go. Well, that's great. Now, one other topic
mm-hmm.
I covered before we close is the idea of how to spend life lavishly.
Mm-hmm.
That I thought was interesting phrasing, spend life lavishly.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us about that?
So this is the fun part of Waldenomics. A lot of Waldenomics is how to minimize. And this is the other part, is how to spend. The point of minimizing isn't to have and to do less. The point is to have and to do more of what matters to you. So according to Thoreau's life, if we follow like how he lived his life, there are three elements to a life well lived. And for him, number one, connections with his family and his community. Number two was activism. He was very active on the Underground Railroad. He was a very outspoken abolitionist. And then number three, hobbies. He was he studied nature. He loved being out in nature whenever he could. And what's interesting is just this past January, so this was long after my manuscript was finalized, the Surgeon General said that people need to have three things to live a healthy life. And he said it was relationship, service, and purpose. And he called that the triad of fulfillment and the core pillars of community. And they're the same three things that Thoreau focused his life on. So the point of minimizing, after we've minimized and say we freed this time and we freed this energy and freed this money, now how can we use it on what matters? Those connections, the activism, the hobbies, because these are the things that, you know, mark a life well lived. And so, again, the fun part, let's spend that Waldenomics profit.
Wow, listen, you know, and right now the idea of connection, you know, is being kind of being thrust into the forefront, you know, and activism, especially activism
mm-hmm.
now, you know,
yeah.
is taking but in hobbies, you know, that's one of those things where I think people, not everyone, but many people think of hobbies as a waste of time or,
mm.
you know, or something that is unimportant to life.
Mm.
And I'm one that, you know, does not think that way. I mean,
right.
I'm a nature photographer. That's one of my hobbies.
Oh,
you know,
nice. Yeah.
Among many other things. But those are the things that bring me joy. So I know what hobbies can do for someone,
mm-hmm.
But I think it's important for people to, you know, kind of reexamine, you know, what their hobbies are and maybe devote more time to them.
Absolutely. And there are studies that show that hobbies are medically very important. People who devote their time to hobbies, they have lower blood pressure, they have a lower risk of dementia. I mean, it really makes a difference to our health. And I think that was one positive thing that came during the pandemic when people had more time. They spent more time on their hobbies. And a lot of people have decided that we don't want to give this up because this is what life is about. It's about fun. And part of the book is about differentiating fake fun from real fun.
Mm.
And like fake fun would be the stuff you kind of get sucked into, like scrolling on your phone. It might be fun for like 15 seconds. And then, you know, there you are half an hour later wondering what you've done with your time. But really focusing on And it's going to be different for everyone. What is your definition of real fun? Like, what really makes you connect with yourself, connect with the world, and enjoy yourself and devote time to that? Because like I said, it's not just trivial. It's extremely important for someone's health and mental health.
Yeah. Well, now I'm going to be looking at things and thinking, what's faux fun?
Right? What do you think would be faux fun? Is there something that you think of, like, phones are the easy ones?
You know, I personally, you know, can't think of anything that I do every now and then get, you know, roped in, you know, to some of the rabbit holes online, you know.
Yeah, right.
Well, you know, particularly, not necessarily social media, but like mm-hmm. the news stories, you know, that
yeah.
and they'll have a link to this and a link to that. And then before I know it, I'm like three links or four links in. It's like, what am I doing here? You know.
So, I'm right there with you. Yep.
so that's what, you know, but other than that, you know, like I say, you know, my photography, so I'm a crocheter for, you know, 40 years. So, you know, that's one of those. But one of the things I've noticed is that when someone's involved in their hobbies, you know, be it photography or gardening or woodworking, that quite often those are very kind of unintentional meditative activity.
Mm, you're right. You're right.
Yeah.
That is definitely a form of meditation.
Yeah. So, and, you know, so I think that, you know, for people out there, you know, if you've been not given time for your hobbies, that do definitely do that. So.
Right.
Yeah. So, Jen, what do you hope that people are going to kind of take away from reading Finding Your Well Then?
I would love for people to find a way to escape. So everyone's feeling so pressured right now and feeling so down, and things can feel pretty hopeless. And I think what Thoreau tells us is to refocus a bit. Like he has a line that it's not what we look at, it's what we see. And to see the potential that we have in our lives that we might forget day to day, that we have more options than we realize, and to focus less on what's important to society around us and to focus more on what's living well for us? What things do we need to do to have a life well lived? Because, I mean, we only go around once, and let's do the best we can while we're here.
Yeah, yeah. Now, some people think maybe we don't go just one time. But then
That's true.
Then again, it's important to maximize, you know, while you're here. Maximize
right.
your time while you're here.
Right.
Yeah. So now, from looking at your website, mm-hmm. JenMcGivney.com, you also have you know, other items like a portfolio mm-hmm. of different items. So, what would some of the things that people can discover at your website?
I do some work. Most of my work is for Charlotte Magazine right now. I'm a back page columnist, and I devote the column to kind people doing good things quietly, because I think there are so many people making a difference out in the world who aren't calling attention to themselves. And the more I learn about them, the more I realize I need to keep up, because there are so many good people out there and I need to be one of the ones doing it. So I write a lot of columns about that. And then in addition, there are some about social justice. There's some about nature and meditation. I'm a freelancer, so I have the luxury mm-hmm. of getting to do a little bit of everything. So, yeah, there's a collection on there.
Well, that's great. Well, you know, and it's wonderful to have a resource, a spot to go for good stories, you know, good uplifting stories kind of thing, because there's too many sources otherwise.
Agreed. And those the good stories are out there, and the good people are out there. And, again, it's not only what you look at, but what you see.
Exactly. Well, Jen, I really want to thank you for your time today. I've enjoyed our conversation, and I've learned that I have a capsule wardrobe and didn't even know it. and I really enjoy the topics that you cover in your book. You know, it's a good read, and for people to do that grand reassessment of their life.
Robert, thank you so much. I've been looking forward to this, and it's so nice to talk to a like-minded person, and thank you for your time today.
You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my special guest is Jen McGivney. And we've been talking about her new book, and it's available for pre-order at all your favorite book outlets, as well as from her publisher. It's called Finding Your Weldon, How to Strive Less, Simplify More, and Embrace What Matters Most. And again, you can find out more about Jen and those wonderful stories by visiting her website, which is jenmcgivney.com, and that's JenMcGivney.com. And everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.